Welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. Not much to say for the intro. I don't even know why I'm recording one, honestly, because I just found out that Steven and I got accepted for this incredible apartment that we wanted. We have been looking at apartments and we came across this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous apartment. 2 bedroom, 2 floors, 1.5 bath, completely renovated, gorgeous, stunning. I'm so excited. And we found out that we got approved. So we're moving and it's July 1st and that's in 10 days. And I feel so bad that I did this, but I just emailed my landlord and was like, hey, I have to move out. What am I going to say? It's 10 days. I don't know what to do. I feel like an asshole. But I'm super excited and, I'll figure it out. And if they have to keep my security deposit, they have to keep it. And if not, great, more furniture for me. So yeah, I'm, you know, with the 10 days now counting down, I mean, we haven't signed the lease yet. Am I getting ahead of myself? She told me we were approved. I'm assuming we're signing the lease tomorrow. I was about to start throwing shit out right now. I better throw it out anyway. I think I'm going to hit the toiletry closet because that's where the most junk is. I just saved tons of makeup testers and I love the little mini travel shampoos, conditioners. Do I need 30 of them? Probably not. So I'm going to see what I can take care of and get rid of tonight. And this episode is with a very funny comedian, Robbie Hoffman. Check her out. She's a special called Nervous. And I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Bye. Subscribe, rate, and review.
Oh, here we go.
Audio's recording.
Okay.
Can you stop?
Here we go. Yeah. Mazel tov. We made it. We're only at the Comedy Store. You know.
Do we look alike?
No. Do we? Is this something you're considering?
I see my face in your face.
Okay, first of all, I'm taking that as a huge compliment. Obviously people watching this are not watching to look at me if it's of me and you.
It's of us together.
So then it's definitely looking at you.
I
don't need to be on camera. And as Josh showed us what the camera, I will say that you were like the whole screen and then you could see me in a tiny dot. Like even Josh was admitting.
I think he only did that to show me the shot.
Like he was even admitting, like, here's the show. Robbie is lucky, you know. No. We weren't even going to have a camera on her, but you know, just to make you feel, me to feel equal, he has the camera on me, but I know it's not really on.
Wait, no, Josh, do we look alike or no?
Absolutely not.
I look like Josh.
There you go. Absolutely not.
I look more like Josh. Will you pop on here for 3 seconds? Okay, you have to come to my side because
you're
it's
saying
like
that
more...
you look more like Josh.
Yeah,
than me.
Josh and I look more alike. Okay, that were you see
lower.
Josh claims he's not Jewish.
You
which is
actually,
anti-Semitic.
I do
it's
see similarities. I do see similarities. No, yeah. I was looking on your Instagram before you came here, and I saw your maybe it was your high school photos.
Oh, and we look alike.
And I was like, I look like her there.
Yeah, because I'm low-key pretty. Like, if I wanted to be.
You are pretty.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If I wanted to be, like, it is a possibility. Yeah. I just want folks to know, like, thank me. I'm not competing with you all out there. But if I wanted to, we'd have ourselves a competition. It's possible. It's possible.
We could compete if needed.
If I wanted to put in the time and go to Sephora or something like this, I don't know where people are going, if that's still the one they're going to. But if I did go to that, or what's the other one? Ulta.
Yeah.
If I walked to Ulta, I went to the Kylie stand, something like this, we could bust out these lips. Like, I could plump them up. We could really do damage. I mean, girls, I'm coming for your boys.
You know? I see it. No, it's very beautiful.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
I think the difference was no glasses and hair down long.
And do you wear glasses?
Do I?
Yeah, at home. Okay. Okay.
No.
But you thought
no, 2020.
You saw me and you're like 2020, 2021. You saw me and you're like, we look alike.
Yeah, I
were
was
you
like,
upset by that? That must be upsetting.
No, I was like, oh, that's funny. I feel like I looked like her in high school. Like, I felt like our high school photos looked similar. Because I feel like in, I don't know how old you are.
Right. Yeah, but same era. Like,
but we all looked the same then.
It was the BCBG, which, by the way, was a BCBG dress, which wasn't nothing. I think it was $340 Canadian, whatever it was at the time, which... Standard dresses used to just cost $300. Like, if you had to go to a thing, you were paying $300. Is that still the case with women who dress femininely? Is a dress just $300, give or take?
It's even more expensive.
What is it now?
But yeah, I mean, like, it really depends. But yeah, $300, I mean, like, $300 is expensive for me to spend on a dress.
Huge.
But it's like, it better be for an occasion.
Oh, yeah.
That you'll reuse over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you have the Bebe shirt?
No, this is my version of the Bebe shirt. This is Bosch shirt. And like I was saying earlier, before Josh could even record, it took a half hour for Josh. There's so many buttons he has to press and levers, and he finally got it all. It's like a symphony what he's running there. He's the conductor, and all the different levers are like different players in the orchestra. But Josh finally got this thing going, and then I realized it was video. And I was saying to you, if I knew it was video, I don't know if I would have worn a label. By the way, the label is new for me. It's a vintage shirt. It's an old shirt with the label. So that's why I'm, you know, I'm not walking into Boss. But, you know, also supporting Boss, some Jews would be anti, some Jews would be, you know, but, you know, he designed the Nazi uniforms, which you didn't know.
No, I didn't. So is that the, with like the patch on the side? I mean...
With the patch.
Okay, yeah, yeah, so you're going to realize throughout the podcast that I'm very bad at history.
Okay, I love this. Well, I don't know. Okay, does Josh work? And Josh, you're in the room, so I'm not. Does Josh work like, you know how people have, you know, like Tim Dillon has been? Like, are you able to pull stuff up or no?
I do not have that ability just yet, but soon.
I don't think he was planning on that type of work for the day. No, but if he does want to, but if he is sitting here and does want, and if you do want to throw him a question or
like if you
something.
Pulled up the uniform, like look up,
I'll just Google
look
it.
Up Boss, Hugo Boss, Nazi uniforms, and you'll see how gorgeously tailored they are. And the reason, and people listening, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember learning that it was in order to draw the youth. Into the, there was like a Hitler Youth movement,
yes.
And it was to make them so they were wearing gorgeous clothing, you know, so that you're not just in some Cub Scouts thing that isn't beautifully tailored. But look at that. Look what Josh has up there. And you're Googling, Chelsea, so you can see it closer because you know he's not going to zoom that for anyone. Oh, there he is.
I never realized that.
And they're like really beautifully tailored. And that's when you watch those old Nazi movies. Well, they're not old, new ones that use the old, you know, it always looks so glamorous because it really was a glamorous affair.
Wow. I had no idea about
you
that.
You know, they were gazing Jews in the other room, but for everybody not in the gaz room, it was a pretty nice event, as you can see from the Hugo Boss spring collection over there in 1939 or whatever.
So do you have feelings around wearing that shirt or are you cool with it?
I'm cool. Now it feels like I'm laughing at
him. Because I know that you...
You know,
really identify with being Jewish.
I do. Whether, you know, there were points and we'll get into it. I think for me now it's like they're like Jews drive Mercedes and BMWs and, you know, some people I would never drive. You know, it's like, yes, we're laughing. You know, first of all, this was a long time ago. So, you know, I don't know if I would have been wearing this shirt in the 30s, but now it's their grand, you know, now it's like, you know, they've, you know, been trying to. You know, it's not the same place it was, obviously. So,
right.
But so
there's been a rebranding.
Yeah, no, boycotting a company from 80 years ago doesn't really do anything to me. I understand if people want to do that, fine. But for me, it's more like if anything, we're reclaiming. Like, ha, you didn't want me wearing this, so I'm wearing it.
Oh, okay.
Nobody thought that I would be wearing this to my own volition, and I am. And that's the same thing. I thought if people want to drive a Mercedes or something, it's like okay, like you can look at it like no, I would never, or you can say. But guess who's driving the Mercedes now?
So when you saw that, did you think, oh, that'd be funny if I got that?
I thought like, huh, I like the fit. Everything I buy when you're a dyke like me, when you're a girl who dresses like boys, like for me, I don't even really get to like choose my style so much as what fits that isn't the girliest thing. So I buy a lot of men's clothes, but I'm small. So I don't fit into a lot of men's clothes. So I'm constantly fit is very important to me. So
you're
I
like a 90s boy.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's like bigger, baggier.
Yeah, it's bigger. It's shorter. Mm-hmm. Now the shirts are very long. So oh, yeah. This is a shorter shirt, so I get away with it. So I almost don't look what's on a shirt. If it fits the way I like it to fit, I'll kind of do it. That's it. I'm not wearing a swastika. You know, there is a line, which, you know, I don't know if those shirts, you know. But, yeah, I guess I thought about it for a little bit of a second. In terms of, like, somebody who's into being Jewish, I think when I was, like, coming out, or I was viciously outed, actually. Like,
really?
Oh, yeah.
How old were you?
I was, like, 18, 17, 18. Here's what happened. But so I never grew up thinking I was gay. I never was, like, I played with Barbies, which I guess was a sign looking back, but I wasn't a typical, I was very feminine, almost outward, like probably like on purpose, you know, to overcompensate to some extent, but I really didn't know I was gay. I didn't like grow up thinking, I don't know, you know, I know a lot of people do, but really when I met my first girlfriend who, she opened me up to it. That's when I knew I was gay, but I didn't before. So we were secret.
Yeah.
This girl. Okay. It was in, we were in like the equivalent of like a pre-college. I went to high school in Montreal, and after high school in Quebec, you have something called CEGEP, which is like a college prep before university. It's a system that makes no sense.
I've heard of that before.
Okay, fantastic. Anyway, so we were in this program and we were secret, and I was very big about being secret because I was like, after my whole life, I'm like, I can't have another thing. Like when I found out I was gay, I'm like, what? Another thing? Like already I'm like one of 10 kids. My mother's hearing impaired, or poor as can be. I'm living on my own now. Like I'm just like, let me marry rich and be done with it. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I was hot at the time, as you noted from my Instagram, Robbie Hoffman on Instagram, to check out those. And I thought like, and I did very well. I gave what, 9 hand jobs in the 9th grade? I mean, I really.
That's a lot.
I mean.
That's more than I ever did.
Yeah, I was doing really well. Like I was on a path to success.
Do you think you were overcompensating, or were you just in the experimentation phase?
Yeah, I was in the, you know, looking back, maybe. Like, but I was never attracted to my friends either. And I have dyke friends now who are like, oh, I'm always into a straight girl. Like, I've never had the straight girl crush. Like, for me, it does not interest me to be into people who are not into me.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have that. But some girls like this idea that's
turning
girl,
someone out.
Yeah. Or the girl, like, you know, they like a challenge. You know, I like a challenge, but not of a sexuality. Like, I don't want to change the sexuality of somebody.
That was very big, I feel like, in my high school. You know, like girls. Whoever was secretly gay would hook up with someone who was straight, and it was like a whole power dynamic. So is that what you're kind of referring to?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like right. The straight girl crush. So I never liked my friends, and I never really knew about it. And I had crushes on boys, but everyone's kind of the same. And, you know, we were all like, and we were Jews. We were all like slowly developing. Like we were all looked small for a very long time.
Do you think you just hadn't been exposed to like hooking up with a girl, and it was only until the moment that you did, or is it more about the person you're with?
Yeah, I think I hadn't been exposed. I haven't thought about it much. And I also, and a mix of it being the person and just really not wanting another thing to be different. Like, I just didn't allow, like, even when I knew about it. Like, I remember at one point asking my sister about Rosie. Because my sister was like, Rosie's gay. And I'm like, no, she's not. Like, what are you saying? Thinking she's, like, crazy. And she's like, I'm like, she has a crush on Tom Cruise. Like, hello. And then she's like, no, she does. Like, she's gay. Like, you know, and then I remember asking her, I was like, I asked my other sister, I said, like, what do you think of the fact that Rosie's gay or something? And she said, you know, she said that line that God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And I was like, excellent point. Fantastic. Case closed. I remember being like, case closed on gay people. She, you know, you can't argue with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There it is in black and white. So... yeah, so we were secret. We were in class together, and then I remember we would speak on like MSN all night. We would speak on MSN. I was watching, this is the craziest thing, but I was watching musicals on TV. I would like put a musical on and like
still
type
no
with
idea
her.
You were gay?
No, but that's guys. Like, guys watching musical was gay.
Oh, really?
Dykes watching musicals, there was no, I don't think.
I guess you don't hear that stereotype
no,
as much.
No, because it's not. I'm like the weirdest gay. Like, I'm like, am I a gay guy or a gay girl? What's going on? You know, so I like fashion. Like, what's going on? Who am I really? So we would talk all night long. This is before we were together. And I really was talking to her in a way that I didn't talk to other girls. We were sharing everything, personal, emotional, that stuff. And then she asked me one day. Oh, she said one day that her gym intensive for school was camping. And that she would be going on this camping trip. And she heard that one of the girls on the camping trip that she's in a tent with was gay.
Hmm.
And that if this girl kisses her, what should she do? And I was like, I don't fucking know. What are you, gay? And I blocked and deleted her. Like, I like the fact that she
Was she testing you?
Yeah, she was testing me. So I blocked and deleted her. We see each other in class the next day. I'm like, you're fucking freaking me out with this. I don't know what you're going to do on this camping trip. Anyway, by the end of the school year, everybody had to go out for, like, beers, like class beers, whatever, college. And we were in the bathroom for these beers, and she'd kiss me. She followed me to the bathroom, and she kissed me. And the first thing I said was, well, at least not out here, at least, like, in a stall. And we went to the stall. So I just knew that it was something I wanted, but I hadn't even addressed it until that moment. And then I remember feeling her stomach, being like, whoa, you're ripped. It's the first thing I ever said to a girl, but I'd never seen, like, a ripped girl. I guess I'd never felt a girl, so I don't even know why. I said whatever I was thinking. And she was skateboarding and doing all kinds of stuff. But we were closeted then. We entered a relationship where I was, like, deeply, deeply closeted, mostly from friends. It was, like, a social thing now because I had moved out of my house. I was feeling distanced from my family. I was feeling distanced from my Judaism. Like, you're saying you were Jewish. I was like, I don't really, you know. And so my friends was all I had at that age, you know. So I really, and they were still, though not religious, conservative, definitely traditional. We didn't have any gay friends, that sort of thing. Or if we did, they were closeted. So it was like, even though it was like, people think like, oh, that stuff only happened in the 80s and 90s. Like, no, it was still in my world. Mm-hmm. I still went to a really conservative school. That sort of stuff.
And so, was this a Hasidic?
No, just a regular Jewish community, but I would say conservative Jewish community.
Okay.
A community that does the holidays, that they're pretty traditional, like a man and a woman, good jobs, that sort of community.
Yeah, like they don't use their phone, work on the weekend or
well,
Saturday.
No, they still would.
Yeah.
But it's just they're more, they have traditional, kind of like traditional American values.
Okay.
You're more Republican type, like family, you know, like looking like that. So it was like a different type of, like, you know, the community I was born into, the Orthodox Jewish community, obviously is like, you know, clearly clearly not allowing gay people. But there are nuanced, even in some of the more secular Jewish communities, they have traditions that aren't necessarily tied to Judaism, but just in traditional values. So I was in that community by then, and these were my friends. And to this day, actually, some of them are still my friends. And we've, you know, everybody's come a long way, but I was really scared to be gay because I knew one gay girl that when she came into the calf, I'd be like, look at that dyke. Like, that's how everybody was. Like, she was the dyke who came in. I didn't want to be the dyke who comes in the thing. So I was looking extra feminine probably those years. Yes, for overcompensation if I like, you know, really therapize it. But I don't even know if that's a word. I decided to throw it in a sentence, Josh. I'm looking at you. As if you're going
to... Why do you have to look at him for the vocab?
Yeah, I don't know.
You can't trust vocab?
I'm kind of just also testing if he's paying attention.
I'm paying attention. I have no clue what's the correct
therapize,
word.
Therapize. Psychoanalyze.
Psychoanalyze. And then we were at a student bar, and we were getting sloppy, and we made out in the bathroom again, classic spot, and somebody from my school had seen,
mm-hmm.
and she told everyone. And it was like walking in. It was like out of a movie. It was kind of like, have you ever seen A Walk to Remember?
No, but.
Okay, A Walk to Remember. Some type of picture comes out. I forget what it is. She walks into the cafeteria. Everybody's like, you know, I had that. Like, everybody was like looking at me. It was extremely scary. I was only like 17 or 18 years old and potentially losing all my friends, which some of my friends did stop talking to me. So
fuck them.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've come around since and apologize, you know, it's also the culture that we grew up in was so traditional. It was Jewish traditional, not necessarily very religious, but still, like I said,
mm-hmm.
So it was really, really scary. I felt like I'd given up everything for this, which I was like, gay is one of the, I didn't even, it's not my most important thing even.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Career and all that stuff and getting out of being poor was a lot more important to me than getting to just like gallivant with a girl. So I felt like, ugh, you blew up everything for this, you know, whatever, your sexuality, which I didn't prioritize at the time.
So from there, did you retreat a little bit or did you just say, okay, I'm going to double down and now live the life I want to live? It's already been exposed.
Yeah, I kind of did a little bit of both. There was a retreating period. You know, I had friends. I had a friend who said, you know, like, oh, you know, you lied to me, so I can't be friends with you. You know, the people who say they lied to you, it's like, I lied to myself. First of all, you're allowed, if you're closeted, you're allowed to lie about being closeted for as long as you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're allowed self-preservation. You know, there's no, you don't owe anyone the full truth, especially when you're still figuring it out and not knowing what the hell is going on. You know, I was hoping to get back on track. I was hoping, like, it's a bit of a detour. We're going to get back and you know. So then I started feeling that freedom, you know, that release. I was so much lighter, my shoulders, you know, everything was just lighter. And I liked, you know, holding hands in public. And so I went the other way. I really leaned in. And now I've balanced out. I'm probably getting gayer. Like, I used to say, like, what happens when you're gay, but you get gayer? Like, do you have to come out again? Like, at this point, I'm wearing suits to weddings. Like, people need to know what the hell is going on.
I love that idea. I'm getting gayer.
I'm like, you know, I have to tell my family, it's actually getting worse. It's actually...
I want to be, like, careful about how I speak about all of this.
Yes.
But, like, I do see... Well, okay, so, like, one of my friends who did come out... I guess what I'm trying to say, it's nice to see people become more open.
Right.
And like, you know, post freely and, you know, introduce their partner on social media stuff like that.
Right.
So I guess I wouldn't call that getting gayer. I would call that being more open.
Yeah.
Instead
being
of being
more
closed off and secretive. Yeah. And I love to see that.
Yeah. And that's like people sharing their life. That's more being open with their lives. I am probably also getting gayer just the present. Like, it's getting worse. So I never, that initial hope I had when I was 18 of returning to, you know, a more, not normal, a more stereotypical life, you know, has faded since. And also what happened over time is, like, I was able, as I was more comfortable with me, I was able to return to, like, I guess not being more Jewish, because what I realized was, like, whether I think I'm more or less Jewish, like, everybody's going to, I don't even get to say that. Like,
yeah,
I could go somewhere and they could be like, you fucking Jew. You know, you can't really run from these things. You can, but in my case, it's like my name, I go by Robbie, but I was born with a Jewish name, a Yiddish name. And when I switched to Robbie, it was just for stand-up. Like, I was just like wanting to do stand-up. I was working in the corporate world at the time, so I didn't want the corporate world to like think I wasn't living for this firm because that was my ticket out. Like, it was
a
good paying job.
What type of firm was this?
KPMG. It was an audit company.
Oh, okay. Is insurance? No.
Yeah, it's audit. It's an accounting firm.
Okay.
And I was an accountant for like 3 years. So, and it was a steady, good job. I got out of university. They gave me an internship the first summer. They gave me a laptop for keepsies. Like, I was not willing to give that up, but I wanted to start stand-up. And I didn't want people like bringing me up, like my name, you know, Rivka. You know, I didn't.
Is your last name changed as well?
No.
Okay.
So people would bring up by Rivka, but they wouldn't know how to say that. And they'd be like, oh, this, you know, and I'm like, I just want
to
go up. Rivka's
not that hard to pronounce.
No, I know, but it's a hard, but if you're the host of something, you can't remember it easily. So like this next act, I have the name on the tip of my thing. Let me check. Oh,
it's
Rivka. You know, it's just like,
and then
I just,
the pronunciation.
It's the whole thing. It's like, I just want to go up. I only have 5 minutes. We're eating into my time. Now I have to explain Rivka for 1 minute. I don't want to do a joke about my name.
Totally.
I have no interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose my uncle's name, Uncle Rob, my mom's brother. I never heard anything bad about Robbie. Like my mother, the way that she spoke about my Uncle Rob was like, always good. Plus, the times I met him, the kindest man in the world. He like lived in Vermont. He was like a teacher. Like, I'm like, yes, I'm going to keep my R initial. And I'm going to keep the name in the family. And that's it. My mother was like horrified. Why did you have to? beautiful Jewish name. A beautiful Jew, like as if I'm ashamed. I'm like, Ma, within 3 seconds of me being on stage, you think people are like, I wonder if she's Catholic? Like,
yeah.
They know I'm Jewish. Like, nobody's hiding
anything.
No,
you can hear it in your voice. But I've, you know, but I have a question. So did this uncle have like a profound effect on your life? Because it seems like you've maybe not met it. Because you said, because at the time, you made it sound like you don't really know him very well.
Right.
So just to randomly choose this guy's name, Robbie, seemed so random. It was that random as it sounds?
Well, okay, their family. So my family grew up, so I was originally born in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. I have 9 siblings, very religious, born to an ultra-Orthodox family. And we were poor, and it was just shitty. And he was not religious. He was still Jewish, but outside of our community. And so he seemed almost like this utopian world existed not too far from my family. And we didn't have a ton of interactions with him. Maybe I saw him once a year type thing. But he was always lovely. He had 2 kids, my cousins. Shout out to Aaron and Daniel. And I was always curious about their lives because they were just 2. We were 10. They had their own room. Like, they weren't religious. They lived in Vermont in a house.
I think it's interesting you speak about the way that you speak about him, comparing it to like when you were saying, I just don't want another thing. So it's almost like this fantastical escape to become this other person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was like his family was so close to my family in terms of like my mother was his sister, but he had such a normal life. She had taken such a different turn. And the glimpses we saw of them, religion aside, just like the difference in poverty, like to me, they seemed rich. Now, growing up, they were like middle class. They're both, you know, professionals. Both my aunt and uncle are PhD doctors, you know, like they are, you know, they're maybe, but they were doing well. And we just like hadn't had any exposure to that type of world. That was like the first family I saw, like the 2 kids, the thing, you know, they lived in a very quiet state, you know, versus everything was so hectic. I grew up like always in cities, always in the density of the city, never even outside the city. And so it was something he was so kind always. And he checked in on my mother and he called all the time. And the way that my mother spoke about my Uncle Rob was like, even my dad, who I have a contentious relationship with, I don't have a relationship with him now, but even when we did, he never said a bad word.
Does Robbie know that you took his name as well?
He does. No.
Have you ever had a conversation about it? Or do you know how you feel?
Very light. You know what? I had it with my Aunt Sheila, his wife, who's wonderful. She took, I think he's more like, you know, it wasn't as, like now that I'm saying it to you, it's a much bigger story than I thought of it even at the time.
It's incredibly deep.
Yeah.
And beautiful.
I didn't even realize it because we were like we were signing up for the Fringe Festival. Mm-hmm. My friend who was a student also at the time, she was like, now or never, we put your new name.
Oh,
on this document.
That's a moment.
Yeah. And so we went through my list of names. I had like a bunch of R names. I had like Remy. I could have been Ruby. Like I was not. And then Robbie I asked 2 people around us. She was like, Robbie. I was like, yes, Robbie. And somebody else, yes. I'm like, it got 3 votes. The name's Robbie. And then I never looked back. I had a small idea of where that name came from. I didn't share it with a soul. But it felt so, well, to this extent now. This is the most I've ever realized how special probably that was. But no, I don't think my Uncle Rob knows it to the extent. And also, it's not really about him. It's about what it represents, what he represented growing up.
Yeah. And it seems like your escape into the life that you wanted to live that was free of, you know, these barriers that you kind of saw on your life.
Yes. And it felt like a good omen. It felt like he did right with his life. You know, he's been married for 1 million years. He has 2 wonderful kids. Like, he's just a good person. He would write me a letter at camp on hemp paper and be like, isn't this neato?
I gotta meet this guy.
Shout out to Uncle Rob.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah, so, you know, he was kind of, my family would joke that he was like the Ned Flanders.
Okay.
He's like, he would like come visit us, like all these like scrappy kids. Like who were like, you know, basically feral. And he'd be like, who wants to play ball? And we're like, what? So yeah, it's, I guess, a deeper story than I realized.
Yeah. I love that. So I'm interested to hear more about your Orthodox upbringing. If I was going to think of like Hasidic or Orthodox coming from New York, I think real estate, you know?
Oh, yeah. You think real estate. That's really true. I guess I wasn't. Oh, how do you think of real estate?
Because mostly in Brooklyn, I feel like they own all of the buildings. And but that's just if I was, you know, being super broad.
And also, I could be wrong on this, and somebody, if you get comments or something like this, but I have no, by the way, I said yes to this podcast. I look into nothing. I have, you know, I'm trusting you completely. I've looked into nothing. So I don't know if people write you that are positive or negative, or they have questions or things like this. But I think why Hasidic people, and so I can't speak for the entire Hasidic
of
community.
Course,
and
yeah,
there's multiple Hasidic communities. But the people who own the real estate, I think it's because a lot of Jews were there earlier. I think it's just like a natural, I don't know if that's the case, but I think because, you know, Hasidic Jews settled in Brooklyn, in those parts of New York, specifically Brooklyn, I guess you're talking about, though you could be talking about the city as well. And they, Hasidic Jews aren't schooled in regular traditional professions. You know, they don't become accountants necessarily. They don't go to med school. They do things that don't require the standard school system that we know. You know, they do things in their own school system, in their own educational systems. And a lot of them are sales related jobs, things you don't need school for. So real estate, jewelry, things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think real estate became one of those things where nobody was really in, like, you know, a lot of Jews were in Brooklyn, a lot of Haitian communities were in Brooklyn, a lot of, it was a really multicultural area, a lot of Italians and people, feel free if you know a more extended version of this history. I know you know nothing, Chelsea. You've told me you
know
nothing about history. So I'm giving it to you what I know, which also could be wrong. But I think that it became a source of, like, for them, while we're here, we, you know, buying our own properties when they were very cheap. You know, at the time that they bought them, maybe 100 years ago, I have no clue on the numbers. And then being able to flip those and make money, make it a business, you know, real estate. So now it's a big business for them. You know, I think, and I can't speak to those communities now. When I was younger, we weren't a part of it at all. My father, I don't know what he did quite, if I had to look back.
Did your mother raise the nine of you alone? Ten of you alone?
She did. So I was very young in the Hasidic community in Brooklyn.
Careful of the bang on the
Oh, table. I keep banging.
Yeah.
Josh has told us nothing. Like, is this disturbing your whole...
I've been thinking about it.
She's doing your job at this point.
It's really not that big of an issue.
And I've heard nothing about money for this podcast, but if there's money and you want to, you know, throw a commission to everybody who's, you know, helping Josh with his job...
What's your Venmo, Josh?
Josh, what's your Venmo?
I have Venmo, but I'm good financially. So
oh, excuse me, Mr. Money Cakes over there. And he's not Jewish. Okay, I'm done. I'm done.
How similar... did you watch Unorthodox?
Yes.
Do you think that was it very accurate?
I think it was so accurate. I didn't grow up in... I wasn't born into that community.
Okay.
That's the Satmar.
That's what I was curious about.
So that's the Satmar Jewish community. It's also... so. Orthodox communities, like, it's a huge Orthodox community. Those are the guys in Williamsburg, and I grew up the guys in Crown Heights.
Would this be a sector?
They're different sects. They're both as religious, but I know the difference because the shape of their hats is different.
Oh, okay.
And things
What's
like that.
The
they
difference?
Have the, they come their rabbinical leaders of the people who lead them come from different places in Europe, in Eastern Europe, way back when. So they have slightly different traditions. And now the community in Crown Heights is actually loosened up more than the Satmar community, and there's many other sects within those communities that I don't know the names of. There's a lot of Hasidic Jewish sects that you wouldn't know the difference of looking at them, but they would. The way that their hats are, the way that whether there's fur on the hat or not, the way that they shave their heads, their haircuts, things like that. For instance, in the Satmar Jewish community, they shave their heads for their wigs, the women. And in my community, you don't have to shave your head. My mother wore a wig, but she kept her hair under. I mean,
why,
sweaty
and
the
why
whole
is that the women have to shave their heads?
I think it's just tradition for them at this point. I mean, but I could be wrong exactly because my mother didn't shave her head. Now, to you on the street, both these Hasidic women look the same to you, but I know they're part of different sects. That said, they still talk, like they still have community. They're still part of the larger community together. It's just a slight difference, but I thought it was extremely accurate to stuff I remember. I remember it must have been a Shabbos day or something, because like the lady couldn't, the main character couldn't carry. And I remember things like that, like on Shabbat, you know, you can't carry things. There's a lot of restrictions on the day of rest that you can't do, because you shouldn't be working at all. You shouldn't be lifting. You shouldn't be. So, yeah, I thought that the attention to detail was incredible. And also a very similar world to the world that I come from.
I enjoyed watching it, because, you know, I don't get to see so far behind the veil of what that community is like.
Exactly. And it's the kind of the communities, you know, that you could be living right next to and not know anything, you know, really not know anything about them, because they are, you know, private, and rightfully mm-hmm. so. But,
yeah. And I thought the wedding scene was super interesting, and
yeah. And, you know, also at that age, you know, marriage, and obviously I was a kid when I left, but this woman living into her adulthood like that is also a really interesting experience. For my experience, which is the only one I can really talk to, it can't speak for the entire community necessarily, is like we had this unique experience where my mother left the community with the 10 of her kids, and so we all stayed together. Versus most people who leave these communities, they go on their own when they're older. They're like really, you know, they don't have a ton of support. I'm lucky where I'm still close to some of my siblings, and it's just, you know, we weren't separated. You know, we were separated from my father, which is its own kind of pain and things like that. But for the most part, we got to still keep the family together.
That's amazing, especially for such a large group.
For such a large family.
And did she leave the community because of whatever happened with your father, or for a different reason?
Many different reasons, which we'll explore, you know, which I'm writing about now. And I'm excited to delve into. But yeah, there was lots of things. You know, my mother was something that we call a Baal Tshuva. For those who are listening, don't know Baal Tshuva. It's like when a Jew like me, or like Josh, who's claiming not to be Jewish for some reason.
I'm 49% Ashkenazi.
There Can we I go. On what side?
Dad's.
Okay, so you're zero.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people will count I know, but it is what it is, and you have your own say in what you want, you know, not that the community cares.
I'm the most Jewish of anything, though.
Great.
I'm 23 and me. Oh, like, that's the highest percentage of what I am. Over, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So we have to have a bat mitzvah for you.
I've always
wanted. Can I host it?
I know a little of the Torah portion from just going to so many growing up in Westchester.
Okay, great. So you know what? If you have a bat mitzvah here at the Comedy Store.
Can I do it?
Let's do it.
Part of it's going to be wrong.
I don't know it. So
You don't know any?
No, I don't know Torah portions.
That's a prayer. Shalom, amen.
Oh, yeah, that's a part of
yes,
a prayer.
Yes, Shamrei, Shabbat. Was any of that correct?
Some of it was great. Baruch Atah Adonai. I don't know the other stuff.
Wait, you didn't have one?
Well, I had a bat mitzvah party. So here's the thing with Hasidic Jews and religious Jews. So after we were done being Hasidic Jews, I still was a very conservative Jew. I kept kosher. You know, for instance, some things lasted a really long time. I stayed kosher till about 19, you know, which I wasn't really doing anything else. But, you know, people think like, oh, we left this community and then it was like done. No, it's like a transition like anything else. It took years and years for us. You know, I still have actually siblings who are kosher or conservative or things like that. You know,
everybody that's such a good distinction to make, that there is that transitional period. Never thought about that.
People thought like right away you're living life. Yeah. And I'm like, well, no, we're still keeping Shabbos. We're still like doing all these. And in fact, our traditions were all these Orthodox traditions, even though we moved into communities or I became friends with Jews who were still traditional and they did things like Shabbat. All their tunes were different than mine, the way they did things. You know, they weren't glatt kosher like me. I didn't mix milk and meat, you know, so I was still always the most religious kid ever, even amongst other Jews that I later met.
What you were saying about your mother leaving the community.
What was the thing?
The reasons.
The reasons. Yeah. So she had, So my mother became religious, more religious. She was like any other kid like us. She was Jewish, but they were like, you know, post the Holocaust, they were trying to assimilate, do well in business, you know, so her family was like traditional, but they weren't like Hasidic. And she, I mean, my mother describes it. She goes, it was, you know, it was the late 70s. Everybody was getting into something. I'm like, yeah, like acid and fucking doing drugs out of like a VW van. Like, and she was like, well, if you're asking if I had any friends, the answer is no. I'm like, that's so sad. First of all, no. But they do, you know, she jokes about that stuff now, you know, but they do tend to, anybody who radicalizes into anything, I think, might be in a more vulnerable position than somebody not. You know, she was young. My mother was only 17, you know, it was a time where everybody was being influenced by something. There was a lot of political different movements you could join. And my mother was like, I always gravitated to books and things like this. You know, she wasn't a wild kid. She was always into theology, always into a search for a higher meaning. And she radicalized into this community quite suddenly. And so for her parents, my grandparents who weren't as religious, you know, who weren't Hasidic, it was almost a huge loss. And I really think my grandmother, who's no longer with us, rest in peace, my Bubby, who I only met when I was very younger, the stories I hear from her later on is, you know, it really brought her a lot of pain just losing her daughter to this, you know, her take on it, losing her daughter to this really radical religion. My mother, I think, joined it and was married within the year and was pregnant already, you know, like very, very quick. And this is a teenager. This is their teenage daughter where they grew up, you know, in a time for the first time that everybody was starting to go to college, you know, that everyone, girl or guy, went to college. My mother didn't. And my mother was at this very religious college and met my father and was pregnant and by 30 had 10 kids.
Wow.
So it was like, it felt like my grandparents, every time they visited, she was even more indoctrinated. Mm. And the community that I'm from at that time was extremely, it was at its most radical.
Mm-hmm.
It has since, I think I said earlier that it has since lightened up a little bit. The time that my mother was doing all this, it was at its most radical.
Did she have a certain experience when she was 17 that made her get so involved in?
She liked the community. You know, there's a lot of really great aspects to any, you know, why anybody joins anything. But for her, you know, she really did love the text. She loved the philosophy. She loved the Kabbalistic stuff. She loved the Friday night dinners. She loved the focus on community and family. But then she realized, you know, over time how sustainable this, you know, she was having a kid a year, no money, you know, they weren't thinking about financial, you know, they were just, you know, they were in free fall basically. Mm. And it's how sustainable is a radical lifestyle like this, where you're just giving everything to, you know, whatever happens, happens. I mean, when you have sex, we know what's going to happen. Not like whatever happens, happens. This is what's going to happen.
Right.
So it was really, it just got out of control. So I think, you know, there are many specific instances, which, you know, I'll share, you know, but, as we go, you know, different race relations. She was feeling really isolated from the larger community. And there's just stuff that wasn't in line with how she grew up. She grew up Canadian. She grew up sweet and caring and loving everybody. And now it's like, oh, we don't love everybody. You know, we're very insular in this community and we're better than, you know, and my mother never thinks she's better than anyone. And I'm not speaking that this community thinks that, but there is a certain level of judgment within the community that my mother just naturally doesn't have. I don't think she's a judgmental person.
That's cool.
In that way. So it didn't fit with her inner, what is it like mantra, inner, what are those words like inner
values
and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah.
So
how did you go from accounting to comedy? Was that something that you had wanted to do? Was it a random, like, one night you went to a mic and, like, you were like, oh, this is so fun?
Yeah, you know what? The reason accounting happened was because I was, you know, I grew up not great. And when I had the chance to go to university, I was like, what's the least amount of school I could do for the most amount paid off?
Yeah.
And they were like, well, they'll give you a job out of the business school. You know, if you go into accounting or finance, get an internship that summer. I'm like, I could use the money. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay.
So it was like a survival. It wasn't a passion.
And it was like, I wasn't going to go for school. I got scholarship the first year to McGill. Shout out. It's not nothing. I wasn't going to like go to school for something I didn't need to go to school for. Like I've always been almost my own parent, because the way we grew up, I think people have this conception about the Jewish mother as very overbearing. Mm. My Jewish mother was a religious, you know, very busy Jewish mother who wasn't that involved in emotional matters or my career or stuff like that. It's not like I could tell her, like, hey, I'm thinking of going to this school. Like, she would have no opinion on something like that. So I would have to make practical decisions myself. Like, at 17, 18, getting into school, I was like, okay, you're going to be your own mother, your own father. Do you get to go to school and study, you know, art history? No. You don't get to, squander a scholarship.
You have to take care of yourself.
Yeah. So art history, if you can do it on your own at the library, you're not paying for it. Okay. And that was like really what I told myself. So I went.
Which is what your Jewish mother would have said, by the way.
This is what I felt. I felt like if she had the wherewithal, somebody would tell
me
that.
Totally. Yeah. You go read a fucking book.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. Go do it for free. If you can do it for free, do that for free.
That's very much how my family was.
Great. I love that. And I always wanted that. So I was trying to emulate it myself.
I was going to say, like, you know, I had a drug problem. And before I got sober, they were like, we're not paying for you to go to rehab. Like, go to fucking AA. And that just reminded me of what you said.
And did AA work?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, mazel tov, mazel tov.
So
I went to school. And I got I went to KPMG because I interviewed at KPMG. I got offers at KPMG, Ernst & Young, and PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Oh.
Okay, the only one I didn't get an interview at, I didn't get an offer was, of the big four at the time, was Deloitte. And this was like a thing for us. Mm-hmm. And the reason I chose the offer at KPMG was because they included a laptop. So shout out to KPMG. I needed one and I loved it. And I was like, I could take it home. They're like, yep.
For as long as you were,
I was like, fantastic. I like told everybody in my family I have a laptop. Yeah, it was the best. And then I think once I no longer was like so worried about money and I could sleep, I then started thinking about like more creatively, I guess. I always was creative. And in fact, you know, my mother always reminds me, I wrote this short story in high school that she was tutoring a kid in, and then the short story was printed as like a tutor material or something like that. So I'd always had, but I never felt like I got to live the dream. I got to pursue my dreams. That was like a rich kid thing.
Mm.
Like rich kids get to go and pursue what they want to pursue. But those have to just be interests to me. There's no pursuit of those things for somebody like me. I have to be practical if I want to get out of this thing. So as soon as I started having money and stuff, I could think more clearly. I'm not into being a starving artist. I never have. I don't enjoy to starve. I don't enjoy to be poor. I've been poor. It's much worse than not being poor. It's just clear. I know you can have happiness and things like that. It is easier to be happy when you're not poor. This is how I feel about it. It may not be everyone's experience, but I've enjoyed not being poor way more than being poor. And it opens me up more creatively. I don't create more when I'm poor. Like, it's not the starving artist.
You don't have to worry, too.
I can't have those worries.
There's less to worry and more space to focus on. Yeah.
I know some people, like, glamorize the starving artist thing. It's nicht für mir, not for me. So Just for Laughs was in Montreal. We moved to Montreal, so I was living in Montreal. That's where I came up. That's where I grew up. And so we happened to have the biggest comedy festival in my backyard. So I didn't really grow up with stand-up per se. But then when I was like of the age to understand, like I'm like, oh, yeah, this festival. And there was like a big name. I think it was like Wanda Sykes or something like that at the festival. I didn't see her. But I looked up then comedy. And for the first time, I was like, oh, I think I would want to do that. It felt very like I never really even considered it as a thing. I didn't even really know of it as a thing. I maybe had heard of it in passing, but I never realized people do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, well, I got some shit to say.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the comedy club downtown in Montreal, and I was like, what's the best place to bomb? And they were like, definitely not here.
But you knew to say what's the best place to bomb?
Somebody had told me that.
Okay.
And I forget
who. That you have to bomb a bunch of times before...
No, I just thought my first time I would. Oh, I don't know. Okay. I don't know if I knew or I didn't know or who I was talking to at the time. But because I remember before I did anything, I visited my two friends out in Halifax. One of who were the people who said they couldn't be friends with me, but you'll see that we moved on. We got past it and we were friends by the time we were, you know, a couple of years later. And we were having Indian food in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And we had just a really amazing dinner, where everybody was laughing. Like, I was on without knowing I was on, which how annoying is that? Now that I know like what being on is, like I don't do that. But at the time, I didn't know. I can't stand those people. No, it's insufferable. But at the time I didn't know. So I was telling these stories that kind of were quasi, and it was about my mother. Just like different, you know, my mother is endless source, obviously for me and as for many people. But, and I just matter of fact said, it was like this dovetail or this like, what's like when everything comes together?
Coincide.
Josh. Yeah.
Come on.
Coincide.
You're asking me way too many questions that I have my no answers
God.
For.
Okay. Coincide? It was like at the time, like figuring out what stand-up is, realizing I'm funny in maybe not just, oh, you're funny with your friends in a different funny
Everything
way.
Everything just came together
and
in
I was
one
like,
moment.
I'm going to be a stand-up. I'm going to do stand-up.
How old were you here?
I was probably like 20, 23.
Okay, cool.
Okay, I was like finishing university, that sort of thing. And they were like, yeah. Like nobody was like, that's a crazy thing to do. Like my friends at the time were like, yeah, that seems like something you could do.
That's great.
And so it was like, great. So then I got home and I had, I think, looked up so that I knew what, and then they sent me, that club sent me to this, shout out to the Too Much Show in Montreal run by George Braithwaite. Mm-hmm. But he had this loft, this like crazy loft, like in Montreal where like anybody could come, they were smoking inside everything. And he would, it was a really, it was like half mic, half like a book show thing. And he would pack this place in. And I remember like people just like sitting on the loft bed and on the ladder on the way down and all this stuff. And I got up there and I remember walking, everybody was like 10 years older than me. And I had a shot. Really nice guys there. They gave me a shot, but everybody was smoking. I was getting really dizzy from the smoke.
Yeah.
So I was pretty sheltered by that point too, still, you know, friends with like good kids and, you know, I never, we went out, we, you know, we took shots and stuff, which was crazy, but we never like, we didn't smoke and we didn't.
The environment was.
Yeah. The environment like of people having like 40s or having like Jack Daniels bottles. Like I just never had that. And
so it felt exciting.
It felt exciting. It felt older. It felt like, you know, like, oh my God, I'm like, this is what it is. This is what stand-up looks like it's gritty. And I got up and I think like a combination of like the smoke, the drinks, the being nervous. I like said one thing and then I was like, actually, I'm feeling really lightheaded. I think I'll sit down. I'll come back soon. Thank you guys. And I sat down and I went up to the host, Morgan Lachey, shout out, nice guy. I was like, hey, I'm feeling much better now that I've stepped outside. Can I finish like what I was? And he's like, no. He's like, that's not how it works. He's like, you have to come back.
That's funny.
And I'm like, what? But I have four. I only did 1 minute and I get 5 minutes. He's like, you have to come back. And I ended up going back and hosting that at some point. And, you know, a couple
so how was that second time work?
Great.
Great. Yeah.
It was.
Do you think it was nerves?
Great. I think it was nerves. I think it was a shot, and I do think it was the cigarettes. I think it was literally
it was everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
I think it was everything, and then it was great. Mm. But then I also had no pressure about stand-up. I had this great job. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I make money, guys. Like everybody. Like, by the way, like let's be clear. Every 2 weeks, I'm paid here. It's not nothing. Direct deposit, which was new for me, and I enjoyed so much. And I thought like. Okay, like I'll see 6 months. If 6 months is like is a thing, we'll consider. But if not, I'll stay here. No harm, no foul. And then it, I just ended up doing. You know, I just knew it was going great.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, and it was the first time, and it still continues to be like stand up is the only thing I'm in love with that isn't a person.
Mm.
You know, and the first time, and that's what passion is, but it's like finding something you're in love with that isn't a person is such a, it's such a bonus in life that you can have something you're in love with. And it's for yourself, you know, it's just, it's corny as all hell, but it was really cool. I'd never experienced like that burst of finding something.
Yeah. It's life-changing to find something that drives you to want to continue on. And I like feel so bad for people who don't have that.
Oh
still,
my God.
You know, I have friends who just, you know, they're depressed people, but just like nothing really like to live for sort of thing. And so when I hear you talk, I mean, I just love to hear people talk about their passions and, you know.
No, I feel so bad for them. And I also don't think it's a thing you could choose. Like, it did choose me. Mm-hmm. I stepped into, like, I stumbled into it. At every turn, it seemed more curious to me. You know, I like some people tell people, find your passion. You know, I don't know if you can find it. And I don't know if a certain age, like, you know, I don't think nothing is possible. I think you can stumble at anything, any age, whatever. But I do think to have a lifelong pursuit or something, it's like you get lucky. It is divine intervention or something, you know. Not only that you found it, but that you were good at it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the other big thing too. It's like you might love something, but you know, hey, you
absolutely.
Know.
Yeah. I heard someone, I was listening to Oprah's podcast yesterday.
Fantastic.
And she had a bunch of clips from different people. So I can't remember the name of who said this, but they said, if you have trouble finding your passion, just show up and do everything passionately. Mm. And when you bring that passion to everything that you do, like it will open up the doors for you to discover something more. So like make your bed passionately, you know, and that's kind of just advice for anyone who might be struggling, who's listening to this, just the way to like look at your life.
Yeah. Instead of my way to look at it, which is like, you won't find it. Chances are it's fine. You can still have a life without it, but you know, there's a big chance you don't find it. There's a chance you find it. I never looked for it. It happened to me. It's, you know, it's a curse and a blessing at once, you know, stand up. I'm just like, now I have to do this. Like talking about the other things that happened to me. I was gambling. Now I have to do like, I just wanted to work at KPMG. I would have made partner.
But you only did that for 3 years. You said,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. But at the time I'm like, just give yourself at every turn for me to have an easier life. I didn't take it.
But there's no regrets.
Not zero. Yeah. I mean, this is actually a much easier life, living a life for me. I don't understand, you know, shout out to everybody. You know, it's to me now that one of the greatest blessings is working for myself. Mm. I really can't imagine spending my waking hours working for somebody else. And shout out to everybody who does, because it's such a difficult thing to do. And you have to, you know, there's a lot of people who do have to work for somebody else, you know, because they don't, maybe there's one part that's like, oh, you have to be courageous to bet on yourself and stuff like that. But there's another part that's like, well, maybe some people have kids. Mm-hmm. They don't get to just think about themselves. You know, they do have other responsibilities, or maybe this is the best case. Maybe, you know, they can't monetize whatever it is that they want to do on their own for whatever reason. So, but for me, it's like working for yourself, just the gift I've given that I wake up and everything I do, I work for me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to give those waking hours to somebody else and play these hierarchy weird rules about like the boss and you know what I mean? For the most part. So
what does that look like day to day?
Like I'm saying, like
you're waking up and writing.
Yeah. Like even like getting to write this show, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, I'm putting in, you know, I'm putting out, I get to do my dream job, mm-hmm. you know.
So had you written a pilot or did you just like pitch an idea? How did the show come about?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I've been talking about different, you know, obviously I've had like, you know, I've compiled an idea mm-hmm. basically, and we talked about it for a long time. And then when it felt right, it was just, we talked to some other people about it and we found the right partners, and it was just one of those amazing things. But it's like even writing on other people's shows, you know, mm-hmm. I'm a TV writer. I write on other people's shows. It's a dream job. Like people ask me what's the difference of writing your own show versus writing on other people's show. Other people's shows, I'm less married to stuff. So if I mm-hmm. come in and I'm in your writer's room, you know, like I get to just blurt ideas out. If you don't like them, great. I'll come back tomorrow with more ideas. If you like them and there's something racy or you have to fight the network for it or something like that, that's your problem. That's the show. I don't have any homework. I don't have to fight anyone to get this idea mm-hmm. on the air. I don't have to do anything. My own show, it's a different hat. It's like, now I am a little more precious about, mm-hmm. you know, the overall look of things or tone or things like that. So I do have those higher, you know, those bigger conversations. They do mean more to me versus the laissez-faire attitude of getting to work on somebody else's show and just getting to make that show a better version of that show.
That's nice, you know? That you can be detached from the outcome of just pitching out your ideas and not being in your head about it.
Like what? What do you mean by that?
Well, like you were like, yeah, I'll just throw out ideas. And if they don't, if they like it, cool. If not, like whatever. And like, right. That's your shit to deal with. Like instead of taking it on more.
Like taking what
like on? You seem like the type of person who's good about not being in your head and like second guessing or overthinking anything.
Oh, with pitching and stuff in rooms. Yeah. I think it's also because it is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Like just like what anyone else does. Like some people ask me like, how hard is it to do that? I'm like, well, for me, it's not that hard. But for you, who does this thing, like your job, I have an old friend who works at Capital One doing, that would be difficult for me.
Yeah.
That is, you know, I don't go, how do you do that thing? But people go, how do you come up with these ideas? I have endless ideas.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm thinking is ideas. You know, it's like somebody told me when I left Toronto, a friend called me and said, somebody's using your joke. Yeah, somebody stole your joke. And joke stealing is terrible and you're a loser if you do it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was like, well, I can kind of have, like, okay, what am I going to do?
Mm.
Like, first of all, if it was my last joke, this is a problem.
Yeah.
Some people who are like, first of all, you should be mad if somebody's taking your joke. I'm not saying how you should react. But if it's really destroying everything, that it's like, I have a million more where that joke came from.
Mm. Great attitude.
You know
what I
mean? It's like, fine. Yeah, that's it. Like, there's a million, like, if you think you're running out of ideas, you shouldn't be in this. Like,
no, that's so true. That is so true.
All
Josh,
the time.
Right?
Josh? Joshua.
You guys have been stealing all of my jokes.
God, he's popping off.
No, I love that. That's so true. And I just love the essence of your lazy, fair attitude. Did I pronounce that right?
I wouldn't say lazy fair. I'd say laissez-faire.
It feels
the opposite
lazy,
of
though.
No, it's hard. I think it's
lazy
opposite
fair.
Of easy.
It's not lazy
laissez-faire. It's like leave it.
Laissez-faire.
It's like you're leaving it.
Oh, but yeah. Do you speak French as well?
Oui. Okay. Est-ce que tu parles français?
Non, bon.
Okay. But yeah, laissez-faire because I do create and work so much.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's like, I'm always worried, like when I look at all my stuff, like I have a million ideas I won't get to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ones I will get to. You know, I'm no longer like, I don't have to do every single one, but I'm always generating, I'm always thinking.
Yeah.
And I do worry about people who are very precious about like, you know, this or that, because if it's your last night, fine, but you know, but yeah, not every, you know, it's like, there's ones that I'm like, this idea has to have, you know, really big passion.
Yeah.
But in terms of jokes, and mm-hmm. we do so, you know, we're telling jokes every day or something like that. I come up with stuff all the time. And some people who have, you know, there were some people after the pandemic who was like, I have no material because I've just been at home. I'm like, I have a ton of material.
Yeah,
about
totally.
That. I don't know how you have no material. I've never been in a part where it's like, I'm not thinking.
Mm.
So, okay, great for you. I'd love to not think.
Mm-hmm.
Please. I'd love Shabbos off one day. Like, my God. You know, but there are people who decided like, oh, I don't have any new material since before the pandemic. I'm like, what?
How is that possible?
We lived in Anne Frank's attic for 18 months.
Yeah, I love your optimism.
Yeah, so thank you. I don't know that I've ever been complimented for my optimism.
No, you
so
do. I can just hear in the way that you speak. Because it's something that I have to strive for. And I know Josh definitely has to. Positivity. Right, Josh? He's more positive
now. Oh, yeah.
No,
he's very morose.
You know, I'm one of the most positive people I know.
By the way, Josh is like his like cool flex of the Yeezys. Just shows up in the shorts and the Yeezys to record this today.
That's his style, though. He always has something flashy.
Yeah, effortlessly, though.
Yeah.
Good for Josh.
Yeah, that's me. Cool.
Yeah, that's me.
Well, Robbie.
Yes.
I think we did it.
We did it.
We did it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Chelsea.
Shout out anything you want to promote, social media.
Yeah.
Your special, whatever.
Yes, great. You guys can check out my hour Just for Laughs special on YouTube. It was stuck in Canada for a long time. They've allowed it to be on YouTube now. So check it out. Trigger warning, Nazis, the whole bit. Get over it. Okay, Just for Laughs channel, Robbie Hoffman, I'm Nervous. You can also follow me on, look at me looking directly in the camera. You can follow me on Instagram, Robbie Hoffman, for some nudes, some old throwbacks. Some
I did notice
times.
The nudes. How are those not getting taken down?
Because I don't have tits.
Is that really just...
Yes.
It's like the way it's registering?
You can also put tits on Instagram if it's not for sexual content.
Really?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
So it's the style of the photo.
It's just style. It's the fact that I'm.
I was like, how
sex.
The fuck is she getting away with that?
And getting away with murder, folks.
That's crazy.
Robbie Hoffman on Instagram, the only place you can get nudes. The only place you can get nudes. And then on a Twitter for some semi-viral tweets, what did I get? 3.5K likes on something recently? It's not nothing for me. I am Robbie Hoffman on Twitter. Literally, I am. There's a Robbie Hoffman somewhere in like Kansas. 30 followers. Won't give up the handle. Hasn't posted since 2012. I reach out to him. I'm like, hey, $50 for the handle? He's like, I like the peruse on here. I'm like, what is... I'm trying to build
peruse
something
under
here.
Another name.
I'm trying to build something here. It's ridiculous. Chelsea, thank you for having me. I appreciate you.